From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noah.
And I am Ben. You are you. Don't call it a comeback, ladies and gentlemen. But wait, can we get a slam on the brakes noise, Noel? Perfect. You can, in fact, call this a comeback because this is part two of our interview with Robert Mazur. In our previous episode, which we do recommend you listen to before listening to this, if you haven't yet, go ahead and stop this, listen to part one. We'll be here.
And in this episode, we're going to focus on money laundering. In the previous episode, it was all about the operations. In this one, it's what's happening right now. Are there still banks out there that are taking money from drug cartels and somehow funneling them through banks in Europe and other places and then getting money that they can use just out in the open?
And not to mention, I mean, so much of what is going on now has been built off of the work that Mr. Mazur did in terms of exposing some of these techniques that the banks use that we will talk about in much more detail in this part of the interview. So you could kind of look at part one as sort of a history and this part two being sort of more of a present and moving forward kind of perspective on where we are now and where all of this insane undercover work that Mr. Mazur did has led us to.
Spot on. So first, let's take a little bit of a closer look at what money laundering actually is. There's a great article on it at our parent website, How Stuff Works.
I know that site.
Yes. Yes. I would hope that we are, the three of us are familiar with that site. We hope you are too, ladies and gentlemen. In the article, How Money Laundering Works, the author here, the author is Julia Layton, and you always know it's going to be a good article if Julia's writing. The author explains money laundering in this way. First, it's very common. Money laundering happens in almost every country in the world. Second, there are numerous avenues of money laundering, right? So one scheme, for instance, would typically involve transferring money through several different countries to obscure where it came from, right? So we know that $1 million coming from France or London or the U.S. is treated with less suspicion than $1 million coming from Colombia, for instance, or $1 million just appearing in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. Or in the case of the U.S. military, millions of dollars disappearing somewhere. So at its simplest, it's just the act of making money that comes from source A look like it comes from source B. So this is not the money from a cocaine empire. This is the money from a legitimate yet ridiculously successful series of laundromats. Or what's another?
Come on, laundromats for laundering money.
That's a little on the nose.
Yeah. For me, it reminds me of the Onion router a little bit.
I was going to say, or even like a VPN where it like takes, you know, it obscures your location, like so that you can't pin down where the person that's doing the illegal downloading or whatever it is actually is. And it basically disguises their IP address. That same thing occurred to me. Totally.
Or if anything, it slows the process of tracking it way, way down.
Right. So for fans of the television show Breaking Bad, if we want to have a pop culture reference in here, for fans of that show,
laser tag.
Right. There's a series of events wherein a group of drug dealers is trying to find the correct, safest way to launder money. And at the level they are operating at, they are looking for a business that primarily moves a lot of cash. And so one of the would-be businesses is a laser tag place, as Noel points out. And then they also eventually settle on a car wash, another place that usually uses a lot of cash rather than credit or debit cards. The most common types of criminals who need to launder money are, of course, drug traffickers, right? Mm-hmm. But they're not the only people. There are also corrupt politicians, embezzlers, terrorist.
Yeah. Mobsters who shook some money out of some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Racketeers. And then, which sounds way more friendly and somehow
shook some money out.
Yeah.
It just makes me think of Mouseketeer. I don't know why.
It makes me think of that.
Or that movie, The Rocketeer.
The Rocketeer. Yeah. And it also makes me think of, maybe there's a show in Vegas that's mafioso only called The Racketeers. And maybe they, on camera, shake people down.
There's those, you know, those can-can dancers at Radio City Music Hall, the Rackettes.
Oh, yeah.
I made
yeah.
that up.
It's really?
Sure. They're called the Rockettes.
Oh, okay.
Delete all of this forever.
No, it's too late. It's no, on record.
It's already on there. Sorry,
all
buddy.
Right, all right.
Did you already mention white collar, like embezzlement, like high-level white-collar crimes?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. We touched on that, but let's go into a little more detail.
Well, it seems like you have to do this if you're siphoning money out of the company that you work for, let's say you're a high level executive. And we've seen this happen at several companies, Enron, a couple others. It seems like you would want to obscure that money as well. And they're going to use the same tactics that a drug trafficker is going to use.
Yes. Also, one of my favorites, or at least favorite terms, confidence men, scammers, right? Rip-off enthusiast. Mm-hmm. So these con men will do the same thing. Regardless, what they do is they enter in this money into an offshore account of somewhere, you know, someplace, and then filter that through a process called layering, right? So maybe this goes from the offshore account, it goes to another offshore account, or it goes to an account in Europe or account in the U.S., or maybe they just buy a boat. Mm-hmm. With this offshore account. And then it goes into what's called the integration phase, wherein it goes to maybe the boat and one of the offshores goes to a U.S. account, or maybe one of these secondary accounts in Europe or in the U.S. or wherever goes into a business investment. So now Mr. Barnaby from part one is no longer a purveyor of human trafficking spoils. We got really dark with that one.
Yeah, I've actually retired that alias. I'm now going by the name Steven Stevenson.
Steven Stevenson. Okay, cool. Yeah, all right. Steven Stevenson is a whole new man, and he owns a chain of Blockbusters in Hungary or something. And that's where that's where he has made his millions.
Yeah, Blockbuster's killing it in Hungary right now.
It's this one guy.
It's that Steve Stevenson magic. So we see this pretty simply, right? Sending the money through various financial transactions to change its form, make it difficult to follow. Musella or Mazur dealt with a lot of this in the course of Operation Sea Chase. And then the integration stage where it enters the mainstream economy and it looks legit, you know, it's a bunch of Hungarian Blockbusters or something. This means that you can use the money if you're a criminal without getting caught at this point, if you successfully integrate, because it's very, very difficult to catch a launderer during the integration stage if there's no documentation all the way back to the original point, you know. So we mentioned white collar crime, we mentioned drug trafficking, we mentioned terrorist activities, and we mentioned some of the methods of this, right? I can walk us through a money laundering thing called smurfing.
Sounds great, that? Yeah.
Okay.
I remember hearing about this. Smurfing is when you break up the amount. Say you've got $1 million. Whatever. Let's say $1 million.
Okay.
You're going to break it up into a bunch of smaller payments of, let's say, $9,999, because there's a $10,000 limit when you're operating in this dark money field. Because if you hit that $10,000, you're going to get pinged no matter where you're trying to move that money. I tried to move $10,000 of savings one time when I went to buy, I know this is a personal thing, but when I tried to put a down payment on my house, and it got pinged, and the person told me, well, why don't you break it up into two payments of $5,000 just so you don't have to go through all the hassle. And for anyone who wants to do that.
Right.
So
at $10,000, every U.S. bank has to report any transaction.
Yes. And then there's all kinds of paperwork you have to get into.
Yeah. So, The Smurfs, the origin of this name, the Smurfs are the multiple people who deposit these below $10,000 amounts in different bank accounts, one or more bank accounts. And some of our audience members who maybe work in a financial or banking system are familiar with this, and we would love to hear your stories if you've met some Smurfs.
That term was also used in Breaking Bad, again, for the folks that would go out and buy just the legal amount of pseudoephedrine, which is the precursor for making methamphetamine. So there were like, you would get flagged, or they would report you for buying, you know, a certain amount. And if you just go out and buy just below that amount, and you get a bunch of people doing it who they call Smurfs, then you get enough to make your batch. So that's
great. Yeah.
And there are a couple of other things that – there are a couple of other, I guess, avenues we should call them wherein dirty money can be cleaned or laundered. There are alternative banking institutions of sorts, many that are traditional, like the Hawala system in Pakistan and India. These are trust-based systems that don't have a paper trail. They operate outside of government control. And then, of course, there's one of my, as a kid, this is one of my favorite ideas, shell companies, you know, a corporation that is a PO box in some country that's very good at not paying close attention to business transactions. And these companies exist for no other reason than to clean money. So they'll take in money as a payment for some kind of good or service. Let's call it yacht maintenance, you know, Murdoch Farnsworth's yacht maintenance business, right? And what that does is allow people to say that they spent this money, right, to get their yacht fixed, their non-existent yacht.
And it doesn't have to be a fake company doing that. You can do it in a real company that just handles cash, like kind of we talked about earlier, which is crazy. You could walk into a casino if you know the guys and you have a little deal. Just because the casino deals with cash so often, you just go, well, you know, here's some cash that came into the casino today.
Yeah, and those are a little different because they're front companies. So they are obvious, like they're legitimate ways to do this. They're actually providing a good or a service. And there are two ways to do that. We could either, you like how all three of us now are working together to launder money? Actually, do you like how all of us are working together now, listeners? You're part of this. If you're a cop, you have to tell us. Which is technically not true, by the way. So don't believe any of your friends who say that. But there are two ways to do this generally. If we're talking about a front company rather than a shell company. Oh, and just a side note, the reason I love the idea of shell companies is because when I was very young and there were shell gas stations around, and I thought, wow, they must be running drugs or doing something bad. And no one knows. I thought I had it figured out.
You knew what a shell company was back then? Oh my gosh.
Right. I was like, yeah, that's genius. No one will ever investigate them. I was wrong on all accounts. But so there are two ways if we want to do a legitimate front end business. And one way is to deal with a business that uses so much money, so much, cash or electronic funds that it's easy to slip some bad apples into the bushel, into the basket. And those would be things like you said, Matt, like a casino or a brokerage firm. Or you can use the smaller stuff that often uses cash just in its day to day. We could name a few. We said car washes. That's one. Bars, check cashing stores, and America's favorite, strip clubs.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Lots of ones.
Lots of ones, lots of $2 bills. I don't know. Are those common? So the effects about this, we have Mr. Mazur talking a little bit about the effects of money laundering. When it gets larger and larger, what happens is international banks become involved. So BCCI was the seventh largest bank in the world, as Mr. Mazur said in his previous interview. But BCCI is far from the only bank that has been involved with this. For instance, we talked a little bit about some banks in the past.
Yeah, he hits Wachovia, a huge scandal there. We hit HSBC in the interview, and Mr. Mazur goes into pretty good detail on both of those, saying exactly what they did.
Well, guys, I think we should probably get to Mr. Mazur himself as he lived this, all of the things that we're talking about. And there's still some very interesting things to say yet in this interview. But before we get to that, we're just going to take a quick break for a sponsor.
So you mentioned that this is occurring now, and you'd also mentioned in the past, I think it was 1991, you did an interview with the New York Times, and you spoke about the hundreds of leads that were not followed up after the Sea Chase investigation, and it makes me wonder what would have been uncovered if they would have followed those leads, and could it possibly have kind of stopped some of what we're seeing today?
Okay, the first part, I got the leads part. The first part of your, is it still happening today? Yeah, well, it's definitely still happening today because we've got the scourge of illegal drugs all over the world to a greater degree than we've ever had it before. You know, the United Nations on Drugs and Crime did a study a few years ago trying to identify the amount of money seeking secrecy from governments, the amount of money seeking money laundering services every year. And in that study that they did, and you can get that just on the internet, just put in UNODC, United Nations on Drugs and Crime, money laundering, just look for some other keywords, but long and short of it is, they identify that the annual drug proceeds, illegal drug proceeds, were somewhere in the vicinity of about $400 billion. And if you look at the Department of Justice asset forfeiture website, you can see what the annual forfeitures are for the Department of Justice. Keep in mind that that's for all kinds of cases. So pharmaceutical fines against pharmaceuticals for different types of offenses, Medicare, fraud, all kinds of different things are in there. You boil it down to the drug money, and it comes down to there's no way you could say it's more than $1 billion a year. So $400 billion versus $1 billion, that's 0.25%. Clearly, there are professionals that are involved helping people to, in a sophisticated way, launder this money. Otherwise, we'd be finding more than 0.25%. If you want to look at the deferred prosecutions that have happened, and even if we just stick to those that relate to drug proceeds, you know, you have in 2012 the HSBC case. And in that instance, just Google Senator Elizabeth Warren HSBC YouTube, and you'll get to hear our own senators talking about how atrocious it is in their view that a bank can launder nearly $1 billion and nobody goes to jail and they pay a $1.92 billion fine. That's just a few years ago. Before that, you have Wachovia Bank paid a $160 million fine. What were they doing? They had no branches in Mexico. What they did is they sent their account executives from Philadelphia, Miami to Sinaloa and other areas of Mexico to deal with houses of exchange, casas de cambio, as correspondent bank relationships. And what they did is they wound up taking $14 billion in cash deposits and bringing it in over a period of about 3 years back into the United States. They did that on by having the cash brought in by armored cars and flown in, going to accounting houses established by the bank in different parts of the United States. I know one of them was in California. Tell me how it is that you don't have any branches in Mexico, but you decide to market that business. You bring in $14 billion. I was a money launderer undercover. My money that we got from my clients were in 5, 10s, and 20s, so it's a big bundle. If it was $20 bills and $14 billion, I think I did the math, and it came out to about 780 tons. So who'd you get the 780 tons of cash from? You know, you look at the HSBC base, they were repatriated in U.S. currency $106 billion, $106 billion. So if that was 20s, it comes out to about, I think it was 5,800 tons. So I don't know. I don't understand how we wound up dealing in this bulk banknote business the way we have historically, and we don't wind up with very big of a change, you know, in the overall picture, in the way of the how deep the talons of the cartels are into the drug trade. And things have actually gotten worse in the last, or I would say in the last 7 or 8 years, because now there's a body of cases that clearly show that the terrorist organizations are working closely with the Colombian cartels and the Mexican cartels. And you can look at a case, the last name is Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A. Ayman, A-Y-M-A-N, Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A. So Google that in drug trafficking. Mr. Juma is a Lebanese Colombian who was very instrumental in the exportation of about 300 tons of cocaine and the laundering of about $500 million in drug proceeds. And when the funds were traced in that case, there were definitely portions of the drug proceeds that went into accounts that have been substantiated to have been used by Hezbollah for terrorist-related activity. So we have Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and other organizations that have recognized this as a way to generate revenue for their illegal activities. So, yes, this stuff is still going on. That's part of why I feel it's so important to share this information with the world. There's a couple of reasons I think it's so important. One, I think it's extraordinarily important because this case was a team effort. I'd say at the height of the operation, 250 or more. There are a lot of Bob Mazers out there. There are literally dozens of people who volunteer to work long-term undercover because they want to be a part of making a difference and they want to serve the public. And I think we lose sight of that in today's day and age for some strange reason. We don't realize that there are people out there who they're not eager to do this, but if it should happen, are committed to give their life for us, just like soldiers on a battlefield. And the greatest majority of the members of the law enforcement community, in my view, are good and honorable people who are prepared to make that sacrifice. And today especially, when we look at, unfortunately, in every profession, I'm sure in journalism as well, you know, you have a bell curve of life and you have some people who are probably shouldn't be journalists. Well, we've got them in law enforcement too. And when they do something stupid, I think it's really so unfair to paint that stupidity on the entire profession, because the greatest majority of people out there are truly willing to give their lives for you and your families, to give you a better place to live and to give the world a better place to exist. So that's a part of it. And the other part of it is to make sure that the American public knows that this is a constant problem. The equation we're using is the best thing I guess we figured we can come across, but if things are getting worse, maybe we need to reassess what the equation is, because we can't continue to allow governments to become corrupted, and we can't continue to allow a lot of people to get extraordinarily sick from the use of illegal drugs. So something needs to be done, and something that my experience to date tells me is that the equation can benefit substantially from an added amount of education, treatment, and economic opportunity, at least in this country. I think that could make a positive add-on to the formula that we now have. I think it's really an opportunity through this film to be entertained, but it's also an opportunity to use that platform to talk about the issues, because these are issues that affect each and every one of us.
Yeah, and we really appreciate the message that you are sending with this regarding the what's the old definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, right? So Mr. Mazur, what in your opinion, you talked a little bit about education, right, and treatment. What in your opinion should change in terms of policy or legislation to prevent this situation where banks are essentially seeing these fines as a cost of doing business tax?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it goes to the same thing we can say about the wrongdoing in the law enforcement community. Individual responsibility. Holding people responsible for their acts. People, not institutions. Please don't try to tell me, as I've seen people within the government try to tell the American public, and this was said when it was determined by the Department of Justice that the appropriate disposition of the HSBC case was simply a fine of $1.92 billion. When someone tried to suggest that, you have to understand that these are very complicated statutes in order to apply individual responsibility for the violation of, and this is just legal speak in my mind, intentionally failing to maintain an anti-money laundering compliance program. Well, yeah, if you're going to use an obscure statute like that, I can see how you might be able to make those arguments. But, you know, the Department of Justice in 1986 and Congress in 1986 gave us the opportunity to use the money laundering statute, and I don't know why it wasn't applied. It's not very complicated. What it says is, if you know that money comes from a specified unlawful source, and one of those is drug trafficking, there's a long list of specified unlawful activity. But if you know it came from a specified unlawful activity and you do anything to conceal and disguise the source of the funds, guess what? You just committed money laundering. It's a 20-year offense, and I believe it's a $500,000 fine. That's the statute that is most applicable in these cases. And one of the problems we face is that the way we go about working these things oftentimes comes on the heels of regulators who are looking at records 3 years old. It's a real challenge to be able to prove what was in the mind of the person that carried out the transaction 3 years ago. So these long-term undercover operations that capture on tape exactly what people know at the time the transactions were done is a pretty darn effective tool. We don't use it enough. There are a lot of other things that we don't. I mean, I've written op pieces for the New York Times and others about how it is that I would recommend that we really seriously think about readjusting how we go after money launderers. But you know, the long and short of it is we seem to be, as you said, doing the same thing over and over and over again and not being willing to open our mind into the idea of perfecting, you know, improving the approach.
It seems like right now, more than ever, we're experiencing something of a sea change in terms of prohibition of drugs, specifically with marijuana. A lot of areas are moving away from that, decriminalizing and outright, you know, legalizing. What do you see as the benefits and, of course, the dangers of decriminalizing and even legalizing drugs, perhaps ones that are more insidious than something like marijuana?
Yeah. Well, I'm not willing to go past the marijuana discussion on that because I don't understand a society that would really be promoting the idea of methamphetamine, heroin, and a lot of other even more dangerous drugs out on the streets. But you know, when it comes to marijuana, let's take a close look at what's occurring in Washington and Colorado and in a few other states that have across the board legalized. Oftentimes you have a limited number of licenses for the production, and you have people coming from many different corners to buy. And so let's not forget the old adage of economics 101 from college, supply and demand. When you have limited supply, your price is going to go up. So the price that's being offered or being charged for high-end marijuana is substantially higher than what you can get on the black market in the same locations, because they don't have the problem of licensing and all the other issues that are going on. So in effect, we've kind of created green zones for the cartels in these areas. But you know, I really do believe that if you haven't educated and provided adequate treatment to your citizens, and now you're going to open the floodgates and you're going to contemplate the idea of just legalizing all kinds of illegal drugs across the board, I don't see a pretty ending to that whatsoever. I've been on a lot of shows in the last several years, and some profess to be libertarian And when I say my concerns about that, I get the comeback from them. Well, isn't that a good thing? I mean, basically, these people will just all die off and we won't have this problem. That's not a part of my thinking. I don't embrace that whatsoever. So I think the problem is a little bit more complicated than just making it available across the board. I think, number one, we need to get into education and treatment so that we can get the demand down. And number two, if we're going to get into legalization, let's try to get ourselves organized on the marijuana side before we start thinking about, I don't know if you guys know anybody who's used methamphetamine, but I've seen pictures of them, and I've met them because, you know, when you're a cop, you do. And after about two or three experiences, it owns them. I don't want my doctor being involved in that. And of course, one would say, well, the drugs are readily available, even though they're illegal. So, you know, if they want to get involved in it, they can. And I understand all those arguments, but I just can't see condoning as a society on a broad basis, making really dangerous drugs available to a population on a statewide sanctioned basis. I just can't do it. Maybe it's because I was a cop too long.
Robert, thank you so much for talking with us so far, man. It's been quite enlightening. We really appreciate it. We are coming up to the end of our time that we have with you. And I just want to ask you, if there's one thing that you could leave with the audience today, what would it be?
I think all of these issues we're talking about boil down to individual responsibility. I look at the problems that we have out there today and the backlash of bad conduct by a few police officers and how we're trying to deal with it. Some people try to deal with it, indicting an entire profession. I'm not saying that there aren't some reflections that shouldn't be done across the board, but let's try to move more toward individual responsibility. I think that's going to help in the money laundering world. Individually responsible people, those people who are involved in turning hundreds of billions of dollars into legitimate businesses that corrupt governments around the world. We need to let the people know who are involved in that type of activity that if they do that, they're going to go to jail. They're not just going to go to jail. They're going to go to jail for a real long period of time. Until we get that, we are not going to have a lot of people out there who are going to be afraid to do that type of stuff. And I think you can apply that to most of the basic problems that we've been talking about, individual responsibility and not painting with such a broad brush on all these issues.
Well, there you have it. That was a lot of fun. I mean, definitely went to some pretty dark places. Mm-hmm. It really makes you wonder how much of this is going on at the same level, if not worse, than it was when Mazur was doing, you know, his operation. And it's sort of like one of these things where you see someone making such a huge difference in a particular time, but does it make a huge difference long term? You know, there's just always new ways of getting around these things. The banks are not getting any less corrupt. You know, like he was talking about this toothless prosecution.
Mm-hmm, right.
These banks, you know, can afford to pay these fines. It is, as he said, the cost of doing business. And until somehow we change the foundation of this capitalist system where money is always better than less money.
Right.
You know, what's good? I don't understand. You know, I don't know what the answer is, guys. It left me. I hate to say it, but it left me not particularly hopeful.
I feel like he kind of gave us an answer there, and it's jail the bankers, jail the people who you can directly connect with going through these processes. And, you know, I got to say, I think I agree with him. I think, that's where we need to go.
Also must point out that in these actions, it's so easy to paint a broad brush and say, you know, the drug dealers or the bankers. We have to remember that in organizations of this size, you know, the people who are out there, for instance, harvesting coca leaves, they're not living high on the hog by any means. The people who are the tellers at the branch of your local bank or credit union overwhelmingly have nothing to do with this. So just because someone works at a bank doesn't necessarily make them an international supervillain. However, at the top, there clearly are people who are doing things like HSBC did to pay a fine of a little less than $2 billion after admitting money laundering to see no consequences of that action. And right now, the illegal drug trade accounts for an estimated 8% of all international trade. So that's almost 10% of all the stuff traveling around this planet is going to be, in financial terms, some kind of illegal substance.
And will need to be laundered.
And the money behind it will need to be laundered. So there is a demand for this kind of business. We mentioned Bank of America, also Western Union, JP Morgan. And oddly enough, this is a little bit of a different discussion than we touched on in a previous episode. But oddly enough, you guys, apparently banks in the U.S. are being very unhelpful to legalized marijuana businesses.
Well, yeah, they've got a hand, they got skin in the game there. There was a quote from the film by the character played by Benjamin Bratt, Roberto Alcano, where he said, "If your country didn't have my money, your economy would collapse," which I think he may have been right, which is pretty scary. He was one of the main Escobar money men.
And again, the film we're talking about is The Infiltrator. We didn't really talk about that one in this episode so much as we did the last one, in case you missed it. It's worth checking out. It should be coming out, I believe, any day now.
Oh, well, come on, though. We were pretty clear at the beginning. If anybody's listening to the end of this, then surely you've already listened to episode one.
I would hope so. But, you know, sometimes people don't follow instructions.
That's true. I'm pretty terrible at following instructions. Yeah. We just sort of wing it every time. So that is the situation as it stands today. One of the things that Mr. Mazur obviously sees as an error in policy is the use of deferred prosecution, right? Removing the consequences removes any incentive to obey the law. Unfortunately, although I believe every person has the potential to be amazing and astonishing and noble and moral and all that slow jazz, unfortunately, people often only don't do horrible things because consequences exist. In a world without consequences or a situation without consequences, people can turn into animals, and it's very easy to rationalize those actions.
And how fascinating is it that corporations can't be prosecuted as though they were individuals, but yet can give money to political campaigns as if they were? It's a little counterintuitive to me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I definitely feel you there.
And so concludes for the moment our series on money laundering, on the underground narcotics trade. And we have, in the course of this exploration, found so many other things that are captivating. If you haven't seen it yet, we'd love for you to check out our recent video on narco saints, on the religious practices of criminals around the world.
Definitely a lot to chew on there. We really appreciate Mr. Mazur making the time to talk with us, and I think we got a lot out of it. Got two episodes out of it, which is cool. And I'm going
Certainly.
On vacation next week, so suckers!
Good luck, man. I will see you back in that chair.
But before you go, there's one last thing you got to help us out with.
I think I know what that might be.
Shout out corners.
First order of business, shout out one, goes to Jen Jones. Hi, guys. I just listened to your sleep paralysis episode and wanted to share my own experiences. I experienced it a bit differently than most. I have never felt like someone is choking me or seen any apparitions at the foot of my bed. Very, very common description of these sleep paralysis scenarios, of which we got a metric ton of via email, which was great to hear people sharing their experience with us. Instead, says Jen. I lay completely still, very aware of where my body is, with the overwhelming feeling that I need to wake up immediately, or something is going to get inside my body before I can return to consciousness. Often, after a bout of this, I will find strange bruises and scratches either on my wrists or ankles, depending on which limb was closest to the edge of my bed. Anyway, thanks for the show. And then she asks for a shout out. So Jen, this is a definitely unique, scenario with the sleep paralysis, and I find it fascinating. I have no explanation for this.
Yeah, shout out to you, Jen, if indeed it is you writing. And our next shout out goes to Keith R., also known as
The Venomous Moose.
Of course. Keith says, I have been listening to your podcast a lot and have been going through past episodes, and I listened to the Does the UK Control the US episode the day before yesterday, as he writes this. So after being saddened that next month might not really be Independence Day, sob in sarcasm. He's killing it with the indications here. I'm getting the tone. He says, I caught on to the City of London and what that is. Imagine my surprise when reading an article about Brexit that the City of London wanted to remain in the EU. That phrase would have slipped by the uninitiated, but now I am more clued into world events because of your podcast, and I am aware. Props to you, Mr. Venomous. Well, props to you, Mr. Venomous, and thanks so much for checking out the show. The UK controlling the US is a pretty interesting topic. The City of London is bizarre. I know we've mentioned before just how strange it is, but man, I want to visit. There are, you know, there are opportunities to visit. If you're the Queen, you have to ask permission to go, but I think we can probably just go.
I'm down.
Yeah. And if anybody out there, you know, wants to host a couple of, traveling podcasters, just hit us up on conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.
Yeah, a couple ragtag yanks, three ragtag yanks.
And the final shout out today goes to Tyler A., who says, hey guys, long time listener here. I've been following China's island building habits in the South China Sea for a while, and I thought, hey, this topic would be interesting for you guys to do an episode on. There's a reason that they're building the islands in the South China Sea. Tyler says the islands have a long history going all the way back to the Potsdam Conference, and the area has been a hotbed of controversy since then. In most recent news, The Hague has ruled that China has no sovereignty over the area but lacks resources to enforce such a controversial ruling, prompting mobilization of naval forces on behalf of the U.S., which in my eyes is pretty troubling. So this is something that we touched on during the World War III Ways World War III May Start video when we did that, and we touched on some of that on audio as well. And it's a bit disconcerting to see it happening in real life, Ben, the way things are unfolding.
Right. So the case that we're referring to in the UN or The Hague comes from an international tribunal called the Permanent Court of Arbitration. And what they did, the next big step here, is they declared China's historic claims in the South China Sea invalid. This was a pretty wide-ranging, clear-cut ruling that surprised a lot of people who watch international affairs, or especially watch this region. The case dates back to 2013. The Philippines filed the case when China grabbed control of a reef called the Scarborough Shoal. It's about 220 miles northwest of Manila, or for everybody outside of the U.S., Myanmar, and Namibia, it's 350 kilometers. So the thing is, about a third of the world's trade passes through the sea lanes of the South China Sea, including most of China's oil imports, and the ground under it has vast reserves of oil and gas. But there's a growing military presence on the Chinese side. The U.S. has two aircraft carriers in there recently, and there's a live fire exercise that China's Navy was recently staging. So what we're seeing here is the idea of rule-based international order. At least that's how the West would argue it, and the Chinese view of what are seen as historic rights that trump current global laws. And the issue of historic rights or claims to land or resources come up in repeated and tragic instances throughout world history, right? So who actually owns the land upon which people reside, who has a more historically legitimate claim to some piece of soil or a kilometer of ocean or river. And unfortunately, this kind of stuff is rarely concluded in a civilized or mutually respectful fashion. And you can point to numerous other instances of it occurring right now in the world in which we live. And if that precedent for most other cases remains the same, then there's probably not going to be an end to this situation as ideal to all these to all the involved parties. So the Chinese argument is that in centuries and centuries in the past, Chinese seafarers discovered and named islands in the region, and that the country of China itself has ancestral fishing rights there. So there's also internal propaganda going on about this. In July, a state television company in China began a miniseries about the experience of Chinese fishermen in the 1940s, enforcing, coincidentally, China's view of the South China Sea. So what these rights are said to be defined by is what was called a nine-dash line. It's still usually called that, even though in 2013 it became a 10-dash line to bring Taiwan into the fold. This takes up about, it extends about 1,500 kilometers from the southern coast of China and maps out all of the sea in that area. So countries that have borders along that sea, like the Philippines or other Southeast Asian countries, are Japan as well, obviously think this is cutting into their piece of the oceanic pie. So the reason they think that is because due to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, countries have what's called an exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, that goes up to 200 nautical miles, or again, for anybody outside of the United States, Myanmar, and Namibia, 370 kilometers off their coast or around their islands. So it is true that China has been building artificial islands to reinforce these claims. Anyway, we could talk about this for a while, but the situation's clearly unsustainable, and it's unfortunately not a unique situation. Thanks so much for writing to us, Tyler.
And if you would like to write to us, you can do it in the usual ways. You can do it via Facebook, where we are Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. You can do it via Twitter, where we are at Conspiracy Stuff. We have an Instagram now, which we've been getting a little bit of love on, which is lovely. we've been trying to post a little bit more, and I think we might just do a post after we were finished recording the show.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and so, you know, we have a little caption contest and things like that. It's a fun way to stay in touch. And if none of that does it for you, what else is there, guys?
Well, first of all, you have to say it's Conspiracy Stuff Show.
That's true. People have Instagram. Been, yeah, if you're having a hard time finding it, it is Conspiracy Stuff Show.
Yes, and if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you just want to write to us with your suggestions, because our best shows always begin in your brains and then come out through our mouths. Somehow that sounds odd, but that's how it happens. You can write to us. We are conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.